The following Dharma talk was given by Jodi Hojin Kimmel at the Zen Center of New York City. Hojin Sensei is the abbot of the Zen Center and head priest at Zen Mountain Monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org/zcnyc. Thanks for listening.
Good morning, everyone.
And Brooklyn.
And wow, so nice to see so many new people here each week when half the Zendo goes upstairs for beginning instruction. It's great to have you, and I would so love to hear what this turning was for you, why you turned to this morning. I don't know, for some reason right now, I don't even know what hour of the day it is. I don't know, is it this morning? Welcome. And yesterday we watched our second video for the Ongo, which was on Daido Roshi's teaching, which was my teacher who started this Mountains and Rivers Order that you are in the midst of receiving the transmission of, by virtue of your being here and receiving beginning instruction in Zazen and entering the practice of what the Buddha offered us over 2,500 years ago as a path to be free of suffering and really understand our heart and mind, our whole being. And so we watched this video on the Mountains and Rivers Sutra, which was a sutra written by a Zen teacher named Ehe Dogen, which you'll probably hear a lot from if you stick around, in 1240. And he was born in 1200 and only lived till 1252. So he was 40 years old when he wrote this sutra. And it's an integration of Daido's understanding and imagination and skillful means of using creative expression to convey the teachings of the Buddha, which is part of our lineage, is using the creative expression path to sometimes show students the nature of reality through a brushstroke, through flute playing, through some movement. And so I began to, it just came up for me, I started to wonder this week about the role of imagination in practice, life, in life, that we receive all these methods of training, methods how to arrange our body in the best way so we can set up an architecture, whether on the floor or a bench or a chair, that energy can move through our system really openly, and that we have to actually test that and work with that to make it skillful. We get the instruction, but we're also different, so we have to make that skillful for ourselves, what we learn. We learn all these ways, these antidotes to work with our afflictive emotions when we're experiencing dullness, laziness, forgetfulness, agitation, obstacles. Essentially, when we encounter our stinking thinking, how do we work with that? How do we get hooked on that? What's true? What's real and true? How do we set the thought free? Because sometimes that one thought just binds us. And it may not even be true, but we believe it. That's called our conditioning. We learn about how to increase concentration. And how is that made skillful? How do we imagine it to be? How do we imagine that teaching to manifest inside of ourselves in our practice? And it's great that our ancestors passed down so much wisdom in whatever tradition we come from. Like, we don't have to starve to death to practice. like Buddha became an ascetic and he was like, took in very little food, you know, just really cut off the senses and, you know, basically was starving, almost died. And he said, don't do that. You don't need to do that, okay? I'll take that off your plate, okay? You don't have to do that. Also, Bankai got very sick, and he said, just push through your sickness. And he got sicker. And later he said, don't do that. Take care of yourself, you know? Otagaki Rengetsu saw in her grief of losing four children, a husband, two husbands, that she needed a moving meditation. She worked on the potter's wheel, and she showed that that's sometimes skillful, that we don't just be still, that we actually move the energy in a moving meditation. And so we've been given these ways that people have imagined the teachings that can come into our body. And I wanted to explore imagination and as skillful means, and to cultivate what is beneficial for ourselves, for others, in turn. Imagination and reality are not in opposition. True imagination goes towards reality, shapes and evokes it. So we need skillful methods to guide us. We need training, just like you need training in anything you do, a job or something we want to get proficient at. We need to train in it. And yet, at the end, that gets left behind. We don't need to continue. Now, in the eight gates, so Daido has this training matrix that we work within. You'll learn about that if you like to. And in the glossary, I looked up skillful means. And the word for it is upaya, which means skillful means. And it says forms that the teaching takes, reflecting their appropriateness to the circumstances in which they appear. Their purpose is to liberate the clinging mind so we can guide ourselves. So the Ango theme for this 3-month period that we're working with is the mountain training. We're looking at these areas of training. And it's been a great Ango. I hope those of you that are formally in it are enjoying it. For me, it's been a lot of re-meeting my teacher. He's died in 2009. And I've been reading his books again, listening to his talks and hearing his voice and hearing the teachings like anew. It's been great. And he's just changed his form of teaching, which people do. When people pass, they still teach us. They just change their form of teaching and skillful means. So if we understand the teachings as skillful means, the next question would be, skillful means for what? And as I said, in Buddhist teachings, it's skillfulness for liberating the clinging mind from suffering. So in coming here, we are entering Daido Roshi's skillful means and the skillful means of the Buddha, the whole tradition. And Daido used to say, there aren't really eight gates. So there's body practice, art practice, face-to-face teaching, liturgy, moral and ethical teachings, work practice, right action. He just said, we're just one body, one heart, one mind, but we need to be able to focus on these different aspects of ourself so we can go more deeply into our creative aspects, our moral aspects, our body, developing our skills for arousing and protecting bodhicitta, the heart mind that wants to be a benefit in this world. We have to develop and arouse and protect that within ourselves, so, and see where we turn away and turn towards not creating harm, practicing good, actualizing good for others, cultivating and strengthening our aspiration to be of benefit. And I read this before, but it came back again. So it's a book on contemporary artists practicing Buddha Dharma. And Robert Thurman, a Buddhist scholar, he was the first American monastic of Dalai Lama. And he lived right by the monastery, and he was good friends with the monastery. So I pulled this from him. He says, say you are a Buddha and you're free of suffering, okay? There's imagination right there. Say you are a Buddha. You are. Can you imagine? Say you are a Buddha and you're free of suffering and you feel totally great, as happy as a bee, as happy as a clam, at one with the universe. And then you see all these miserable people. What good would it do for you to go and give them a big grin and hug and smother them with joyfulness? They'll probably just get freaked out and paranoid, and they'll say, what does this person want? You know, we've had people do that to us, right? They'll just get, so instead, a Buddha has to develop some strategies, some art, to open that person's imagination to the fact that there is a world where we don't have to be miserable all the time. And then they have to develop them with a method of how to move from their paranoid corner of misery into the great ocean of the universe that you, a Buddha, perceive. He says, in the sense that none of what Buddha expressed was driven by any sort of selfish impulse on the part of the being that was formerly Siddhartha Gautama, everything he does is a communication of compassion to other beings, creating doorways to open their imaginations and then their whole beings to enlightenment, to nirvana, to peace. So to first present nirvana, first as a work of art, allows people to perceive it and open up to the possibility they can experience it for themselves. Who would want to seek nirvana if they couldn't imagine there was such a state to be free from suffering? So, upaya is Buddha's art. As I said, Buddha was probably one of the first great performance artists. So first of all, to open our imagination to the fact there is a world we don't have to be miserable all the time. What generosity. He could have just gone off and said, I got it. Later, folks, work it out. But he stayed. He taught with upaya, with skillful means, using the most powerful of mechanisms, our consciousness, the imagination. And we need these skillful means, these teachers, these methods to open us. Yeah, this led me to, in the temple notes, we put in this poem by Isa. Under the cherry trees, there are no strangers. Under the cherry trees, there are no strangers. Have you been under the cherry trees with people or any tree? Just what is that moment, that experience of being under them? And we're not strangers. There are no strangers. And it reminded me of this line in Neruda's poem of Keeping Quiet, where he says, for once on the face of the earth, let's not speak in any language. Let's stop for 1 second and not move our arms so much. It would be an exotic moment without rush, without engines, we would all be together in a sudden strangeness. There it is again. That sudden strangeness. And what is it that, if we don't make space for that, to quiet the mind, it's hard to imagine. Because we're taken up by the rush of our life, the busyness. And in the Chinese character for busyness is heart over killing, heart killing. We become entrenched when we get too busy. We get frozen in our imagination, in our actions. It gets really narrow. And do we ever take time to ask, what are we really here for? In real time, what are we really here for? Even in spiritual communities, sometimes people don't ask. Which is weird, right? Think like, what are we here for? If we're truly part of a larger spiritual reality that can offer peace and happiness and empower us to make the world healthier, why wouldn't we enthusiastically embrace every practice that might help us enter into that reality? And to my mind, Zazen is that primary practice that helps us discover and align ourselves with our true nature and its purpose. Taking time to be open and present to a reality beyond what our tiny minds can grasp. Just in those moments of turning around. This quote George Bernard Shaw wrote, that he writes about the true joy of life is in being devoted to a purpose recognized by ourself as a mighty one. He says, being a force of nature, indeed of a feverish, being a force of nature instead of a feverish, selfish little clod of ailments and grievances, complaining that the world will not devote itself to making you happy. And I'm not calling anyone here a little clod of selfish clod of anything. I'm just saying, think about it. Are you too busy to do nothing? Which is, rather than being nothing, might actually mean everything to our happiness. And this reminded me of an essay I read by Janet Roofing. Years ago, she wrote this, which was called The Demon of Busyness. I'm just going to read you a little bit of it. I'd like to read you all of it because it's excellent, but she said, many of us suffer from chronic busyness. And by the way, people always tell me they don't want to take up my time because I'm so busy. And I'm like, wait a minute. Like, how do you know? You know, and I don't say, I know what busyness is. I know what busyness feels like. We have to know what it feels like. But I also am full. I like being full. I like to be full of activity. I enjoy activity. Busyness, I can feel when it turns to heart killing. There's just has a different feel to it. So anyway, she says, many of us suffer from chronic busyness, a sense of having so many things to do and not having enough time to do it. Ring any bells? We keep plugging on, hurrying to finish this task so we can get to the next one. She said, the demon of busyness believes that this unending busyness is profoundly destructive to self-intimacy, intimacy with the divine, interrelationships, reflective thought, the fabric of our society, our care for the planet, and our own psychological and physical health. She also notes that contrary to the way most people think about it, busyness is not directly related to how many things we have to do. She says, she site's sister, Gina from Plum Village, explains concretely how it is possible to be active and engaged, but not in a hurry. When we walk in a hurried way, we don't rest in every step. Instead, we seem to quickly touch the earth in order to get somewhere. So I practice taking the hurry out of my steps so that I can come to rest in every step. Like our Kinhin. It is a bit tricky because there's something in me that tells me if you don't hurry, you're going to be late. But I also experience that if I don't hurry, I will get there much faster because the hurry comes from the worry, and the worry is the very heavy and slows me down. If I drop the hurry and the worry, I can move a bit quicker and be in every step and be on time. Did you ever find that? Or maybe it's just too fast. You can try it. It's a very interesting experiment. You can meet this habit energy that says you have to hurry or you will be late. You can move faster, but you don't need to hurry. It's very handy when you're in the airport and a bit late. She says, so if busyness is not helpful or sustaining, why is it so common? She said her insight is that we become overwhelmed by busyness because of ego and institutional pressures. We lose our mindful connection with our bodies and hearts. We lose our imagination. There is something about the feeling of busyness that is exhilarating. There is an altered state of consciousness I experience when I swing into action and begin working through today's to-do list. A burst of adrenaline carries me from one activity to another. How many things I can done in the shortest amount of time. Racing against the clock becomes a game, sometimes an unhealthy competition, but nevertheless a game. While I'm occupied orchestrating this internal race against time, I feel both strong and important. My ego is firmly in control. I am clearly the center of these activities, and this particular state of mind, of course, is illusory. When I am busy being busy, I avoid making time for leisure, for play, for relationships, for reflection. I delight in moving fast, being caught up in the rhythm of an institution, a city, a community that runs me and overwhelms my internal sense of self and my felt responses to internal and external events. I'm actually being captivated by a false consciousness that is largely generated by the culture outside of me. I go on automatic while believing I'm still in charge. When I am busy, I can believe myself to be an incredibly important in the scheme of things. I become indispensable, necessary. My ego becomes reassured that I'm a productive, accomplishing something worthwhile and valuable. There's a book that the monastics are reading called Making Sense of Mind Only, Why Yogacara Buddhism Matters by Bill Waldron. And Yogacara and Madhyamika are two of the major schools of Mahayana Buddhism. They're different, but they have complementary perspectives on understanding reality and the path to enlightenment. Madhyamika emphasizes the wisdom of emptiness, that there's nothing fixed. There's no fixed self or any selfness in anything that's permanent, stays the same. And we see this in our zazen as we see thoughts come and we relinquish them and just come back to the vastness of the breath, just the breath. So it's right there, and that grows. Yogacara, known as the mind only, speaks of emptiness, but then it focuses on compassion, bringing that into our deeds, how we act, engagement. And so within the teachings of the Yogacara is this the work of Basubandhu, who spoke of these three natures, Basubandhu's three natures, which highlights the imaginary, dependent, and complete realized nature inherent in all aspects of phenomena. You with me? I'm sure you are. Anyway, the imaginary nature of things is what we think they are, what we imagine them to be. The dependent nature is that they appear to arise from countless conditions. So that's what comes to mind, or all phenomena are momentary arisings that come together from countless conditions. We call it karma or karmic. And the complete realized natures that they aren't as we imagine them to be. Things can be things that can be grasped or pushed away. The three natures form the backbone of this Yogacara philosophy in order for us, skillful means, to see beyond our preconceived notions of ourselves and others, beyond the things that we're convinced are true, and open up a path to personal and communal healing. We don't hold each other fixed, ourselves or others, in something. Buddha encouraged us to use our own creative imagination to open our doors of perception. And after his realization, when the Buddha was told he should go teach and not tuck away, he went and taught a crowd of thousands on the Prajnaparamita, what we chanted this morning, the Heart Sutra, the emptiness of all the conditions, what we chanted, right? Guess what? It's in the Lotus Sutra. 6,000 monks, nuns, and lay people left. They couldn't understand what he was talking about. And they all just got up and walked away. Some scholar called it the Heart Attack Sutra. Some people had heart attacks because Buddha was saying that there's nothing inherently anything, you know? But yet, in the compassion part, here we are. Yet, this is here. We have to take care of this reality. But they all left, and Shariputra was there, freaking out. What should we do? How are we going to get them back? And he's like, it's okay. It's my mistake. I started in the wrong place. That wasn't skillful. People don't get it. Let me think again. And then he came back and he taught the Four Noble Truths. And he said, hey, folks, life suffers. And everybody's like, all ears. I'm in. I get it. And that there's a cause for that suffering. That cause is a thirst that's unsatisfied. Either we have something, I'll put it just kind of simply, we have something, we don't want it, or we don't have it and we want it, and we just circulate in that samsara. Never, always dissatisfied. There's this unsatiable thirst. It's called dukkha. And then we can actually, Buddha said, we can put an end to that cycle. We can end it. And he taught the fourfold, and he taught the eightfold path. And the eightfold path, and Dada created that as the, begins with right understanding, and then right thought, right speech. Right could be perfect, right? Perfect speech, perfect action, not like complete. As that kind of perfect, not as right as opposed to wrong, just complete. Complete livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And the second limb of the Eightfold Path, normally translated as right or perfect view, thought, can also be translated, I think, as right imagination. Having the right imagination. In this way, our right view is being able to, the ability to go beyond our reactive patterns, beyond socially imposed norms, and envision different possibilities and outcomes which are more skillful and mindful. That's what we're doing. That's skillful means. So it's an essential part of the Dharma path and teaching to test and direct our experience. What came up for me was, we're an imaginal body. And I realized that term was used a long time ago. Some of you therapists might know Henry Corbin, pre-Jung, who coined this term imaginal from his work as an interpreter of Islamic thought, where he describes this imaginal realm as holding images, stories, dream figures, embodied imagery and movements that come to us beyond dimensions of our rational intellectual perspective. So we have all these methods that we are given that are very pointed and particular, and yet we're this imaginal body that actually puts it into our reality to be skillful and beneficial. Similarly, creativity, which is in Edi in the Pali language, is crucial if we want to liberate ourselves and create a culture of awakening. Have to be creative. So I guess, like, I've just been feeling like, please don't lose your imagination and your creativity. Don't get so busy. Find some quiet time to let that imaginal body come through. In an essay by Stephen Batchelor, he explained how the Buddha often compared our development along the Dharmic path with the creative labor of craftsmen, musicians, artists, doctors, who apply their desire, their effort, intuitions, and willingness to experiment to their projects. Using these skills and qualities, creative laborers begin with the raw materials of their work and transform them so completely into useful and beautiful products that the process is, in a fundamental sense, magical. We take the raw materials of our heart and mind and see them for what they are so that we can transform them into something useful, magical, which we are. Like we hear in our Mulgatha, may we exist in muddy water with purity like a lotus. Have you ever seen, like, a lotus grows out of the muck? That's us. And that muck has all the nutrients we need. So it's the stuff that we want to say, like, if I didn't have that, I'd be fine. If I wasn't like this, it would be okay. But how can we imagine that that darkness, that muck that we sludge through, has this nutrients to make us this whole beautiful being that we are? And once we can imagine that, it comes together. We have much more space to hold the parts that we feel like we want to jettison in ourselves and in others. We accord it with the priceless gift of our attention, he says. Keen attention becomes an act of deep regard in which we grow more conscious. I keep Rilke by my bedside, and I was reading the Book of Hours. And of course, when I'm working on a talk, everything's like, I can use it. Like, every poem is like, there it is, there it is. So I just took one. I love this line he writes. I know that nothing has ever been real without my beholding it. All becoming has needed me. My looking ripens things, and they come toward me to meet and be met. I know nothing has ever been real without my beholding it. All becoming has needed me, my ripening, my looking, my attention ripens things, and they come toward me to meet and be met. The 10,000 things come forward as this self to be met. This is why all of Buddha's teachings are considered to be skillful means. They are part of our refuge to protect us from ourselves and our lack of skill. Dido also cautioned us in believing that we have all the answers as part of skillful means. That we know what is skillful for someone, and maybe you've been in that place where I know what's best for you. Nay, nay. Do we? Maybe, but I don't know. On the deepest level, we can present something, but we gotta leave it open. We could say this has worked for me and many others, but one has to drink it. We can be led. We all know this on some level. So we said to be cautioned there, that we have the answers for someone else, or even that we know what's skillful. Skillful means can take years to initiate. We just practice it over and over, and then it starts getting skillful. In and of itself, it's not skillful means. It takes, my looking at it ripens it. He also cautioned us against arrogance in that way, making someone disempowered with skillful means. Because we know Buddhist communities and many continue to grapple with leaders claiming to be enlightened who say, I'm using skillful means and taking advantage of their power dynamic. So there's that in history, in our Buddhist history. More recently, in fact. So skillful means isn't skillful on its own. And Dido said, don't think we get into an attitude where you take your seat and you say, okay, do me. I'm sitting, meditating. So we actually have to, it needs us. Skillful means needs us. When the mind is free of attachment and delusions, its actions effortlessly creative, boundless in expression, and perfectly tuned to the moment, just like the universe itself. One of our students wrote a book on the Greek language, and in the beginning, she starts with one word on one page, and it's gnosko. And it says, it means to come to know the recognition of what is true by experience. Because nothing can, this is written by I'm not sure who, because nothing can be skillful means unless it has been associated with the earth. I like that. Nothing can be skillful means unless it's associated with the earth. Unless it's occurred with within our body. We're the earth. We need to imagine and visualize and return to our body, heart, mind, to the earth, in and through it, to find out what's true. This one Buddhist teacher says, we need to throw the word visualization out the window. It is the wrong word because the word visualization implies something visual. It implies working with visual images, and it also applies working with the eyes. This is incorrect. Instead, we are working with the imagination. When we work with the imagination, we're not just working with imagined sights, but also with imagined sounds, smells, physical awareness, sensations, feelings, emotional feelings, and so on. To affirm the pervasiveness of emptiness is to discover the fact there is no inherently existing self. So that's what I got on imagination. I'll end with Dido's words. And also, I love this psychologist, analyst, Marion Woodman, who was a Jungian analyst. And she, her favorite, I guess, phrase was, if we could allow the pace of our meetings to slow down to the pace of our hearts, we might find genuine understanding. If we could allow the pace of our meetings with whatever we're meeting to slow down to the pace of our hearts, we might find genuine understanding. And so, how does that factor in with Zazen? It gives us that opportunity to strengthen that ability to slow down to the pace of our heart when we meet something so we can understand, get genuine understanding throughout this whole earth. Daito Roshi says, so please, when you practice anything, skillfully practice your life. Trust yourself completely. Trust the process of sitting. Know that deep within each and every one of us, under those layers of conditioning, there is an enlightened being, alive and well. In order to function, it needs to be discovered. To discover this Buddha is wisdom. To make it function in the world is compassion. It's not great if it's just emptiness. It's got to function. Otherwise, it's not useful. We can't even do anything if it's emptiness. And emptiness isn't a thing. It just, we can't even walk across the street. We got to come back in the world. With that wisdom, he says, to make it function in the world is compassion. And that wisdom and compassion is the life of each one of us. It's the skillful means, the spontaneous creativity of the universe. It's up to you what you do with it. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.